It's now the 23rd of January, and I would like you to start where you left off, more or less, when Young had, or what happened after Young went up to the presidency.
Well, there was some. He was reluctant about naming an acting chancellor in his place, and there was a great deal of concern because people didn't want that vacuum to exist there. And they were concerned about if there was a vacuum, that they knew that Serena Pondrum would move into it very rapidly because of her earlier demonstrations of acquisitiveness. And so I understand, and this is hearsay, but a group of the senior deans got together with Ed and told him that they would not tolerate a situation where there was no acting chancellor named. And he got forced into a corner, and finally he had to name someone, but it didn't occur till he was to go up there July 1st, and I don't think he named an acting chancellor till late in June. And so he took as long as he possibly could to do this.
Why?
I think it was because he had this close relationship with Serena, and he was concerned about her future, and he at least realized that not everyone was supportive of her, and they were concerned about her aggressiveness and acquisitiveness, as I said earlier. So he was going to try to, I think, run things from up in Van Nuys while he was there, and just sort of let things float. Ed has never been one to, in a very precise and crisp way, nail things down. So he likes to live with ambiguity, and that was another example of it. Then what he did was he appointed the senior dean at that time, who was Glenn Pound. And I think the records show that Glenn Pound did more for this university in those months of that summer of 1977 than people will ever understand and realize. And what it was that he literally held the fort in Bascom Hall, and he preserved the integrity of the chancellor's office and therefore the overall stability of the campus at that time. Because without him, things would have been very unstable and people would have been able to take advantage of certain things. But what he did was he literally froze Serena out of any of the sort of entrees that she had to the chancellor's office throughout that whole summer of 1977. And business then went on in a very professional, in a very equitable way. And Glenn did a tremendous service to the university, I think, by virtue of his having come in there and exercised his authority and doing it in a very dignified way over that period of time till we got a permanent chancellor assigned. And then one of the first things that Irv Shane did when he returned was to relieve Serena of her responsibilities. He couldn't have functioned as chancellor with her still in the position that she held. He couldn't have functioned for two reasons. One is, of course, his former difficulty that he had with her, which I think was one of the basic causes of his leaving, and his inability to resolve his differences with Ed Young on that score. And the second was that there was such widespread hostility and bitterness about her across the campus that nothing could have gotten done until people saw that he took charge, Irv, that is, in this way. So He made two major personnel adjustments when he first got here as chancellor. The first was that he named Len Van Ness a vice chancellor for administration, and this was because he felt very indebted to Len for the way that Len had served him, Irv, when he was vice chancellor, and for the special skills that he felt Len offered. And then the second thing he did was to relieve Serena of her position.
Well, now, Ed Young must have appointed Shane.
Yes.
So Ed Young must have known this was going to happen.
Well, yes, but you see, I have a theory, and I have no way of documenting this, but I think it needs to be mentioned because it's intriguing. And that's the reason why I don't want this interview to be released for a number of years now. I believe that Ed Young made a deal with Dave Cronin. And he said, Dave, if your name's on the list, I will appoint you chancellor so long as you keep Serena in her position. And I think Dave was willing to do that. And once again, I'm way out in the realm of speculation. I asked Steve Chafee, who was the chairman of the search and screen committee for the chancellor at that time, if he felt that way. And he said, well, maybe, but he couldn't really document it. But I think what one needs to look at here is there were two Irv Shane champions, I mean real champions around at that time. One was Glenn Pound himself, which is kind of interesting because Glenn and Irv would get into tiffs from time to time because Glenn had a real penchant for going directly to the legislature, and both Ed Young and Irv would get miffed at that, but they all recognized that Glenn was a first-rate person and administrator. But Glenn was a real staunch supporter of her. And Bassam Shakashiri, who was on the committee, professor of chemistry, was also a very strong supporter of her. I think somewhere people instinctively realized that there was a much closer association between Serena and Dave Cronin, and that might have presented some problems in the future. And so when the list came forward, I believe there were four names on it, or maybe five at the most. And the only name on it with a UW-Madison association was Irv Shane, which meant that Ed Young was trapped. Because if he didn't go to Irv first and ask him if he wanted to take the job, and somebody found out about it, his whole future would be totally compromised. In other words, if he went to one of the outside candidates first without going to Irv.
You mean Cronin's name wasn't on
the list? Cronin's name was not on the list.
Young wanted it to be, but it wasn't.
I think he did. And I think this goes way back to, I remember in the early 1970s, Dave Cronin made himself very visible in the chancellor's office and developed a strong relationship with Ed Young, even though Dave at that time was somewhat sequestered, if you will, in the Institute for Research in the Humanities at that time. And so I think Dave, obviously in a very subtle way, showed that he would be willing to consider greater administrative responsibilities if they were thrust his way. Now, I'm not trying to impugn in any way Dave Cronin's character, because I think Dave has served this university well and devotedly over the years. But I'm suggesting that there was this possibility of a conspiracy there, and it had a real influence on the way things were done that spring and summer of 1977 as regards to the future of Madison.
Done in the chancellor's office,
right,
and by the search and screen.
Right, mm. Right.
It would be kind of a repeat, wouldn't it? Because as I understand, Young's name wasn't on the list for the chancellor appointment when he was appointed.
Yeah, I don't know about that. I was...
And that Harrington wanted
Yeah, at
him,
that time I was working in Van Hise, and I didn't really... I wasn't that close to what was going on then.
Borchers was already out by then, is that right?
I don't know. I don't think so. I think he was still around, but it was obvious that his effectiveness had been totally compromised by Serena. Mm-hmm. And that, so if he wasn't physically out, I can't remember, he was, for all practical purposes, no longer an influence.
So when you say that Pound did so well, you mean specifically in regard to Serena Pondrum, then?
Well, that plus providing a presence. I think one has to understand that that part of the responsibility of a chancellor is to serve as a model of behavior. And Glenn Pound is one of the old school of gentlemen. And his behavior to his colleagues, or his behavior at that time, and it's just a trait of his character, was extremely thoughtful and professional, and those of us who served with him have a very warm feeling in our heart for him because he's such a decent person, and at the same time he was a very capable administrator. He's one of those guys who would go home at night and his inbox, if you will, would be empty. He was very methodical in the way he administered things and very on top of everything. Maybe not the most imaginative person in the world, but just thoughtful and considerate of all different kinds of people. Some of that goes back to his own very humble beginnings. He comes from a very humble origin in the state of Arkansas, and then when he first got started, before he ever went to college, he ran, I believe it was a peanut farm down in Texas, or a cotton farm, something like that. And so he knows what people have to struggle through in order to just make it on a day-to-day basis. And he never forgot that, and he always treated people decently. And so he did present this presence in the office, which said there was a person of experience and dignity and compassion there. Same time.
Was this kind of a relief to everybody? I mean,
you said
it, Ed Young, as however much everybody liked him and was glad for what he was doing outside.
Well, there are a lot of us who were very devoted to Ed, too. Mm. But when you look at his administrative style, well, things began to change. And Ed's style was great for the crisis management things that we had to go through. But later, when those things began to recede, then some of the other very basic institutional problems came to the fore. And of course, this was a product of merger, too. And so we really had to deal with these administrative concerns in a very direct way. And we couldn't use some of that creative ambiguity that Ed always fomented one way or another. We had to face it very directly. So I'm not quite sure how much longer Ed could have gone on as chancellor without some major problems developing just as a result of this. So it's one of those things where you almost look at history as a kind of organic process, and here's an organism that that develops antibodies and rejects certain things, and then you get a change and something new comes into the bloodstream and you go on and then a whole new set of toxins and so forth develop, and then you go through this change again.
Yes, it certainly does seem to describe the situation there.
Yeah.
So you were, all of you, pleased when Shane was appointed?
Yes, I think it it represented to people a commitment.
Let me reword that. How did you feel when Shane was appointed?
Well, we had a known quantity that we were dealing with. Many of us had worked quite closely with him all along. A lot of us all came together at the same time, you see. If you look at myself, I was there just a couple months before he got appointed vice chancellor. Len Van Ness had been there for maybe a year or two. And then later in the process, we got Joe Corey added to the staff. We got Joel Skornicki added to the staff. And so we had kind of, and Peter Bunn was there.
These were all the, what is the word for them? That you used last time? Pinch hitters.
Yeah, the sort of utility infielders. Mm. So for example, when Irv went down to work on that health sciences reorganization, Peter Bunn was a member of the team, Len Van Ness was a member of the team, and I was a member of the team. Yeah. And we all worked on that together. So we had kind of grown up as a group during those early years, and we were doing two things at once. We were fighting the crises, as I say, on a day-to-day basis, the campus disruptions. And then we were getting engaged in some of these major structural changes that came about as a result of a number of different things. So we'd all kind of grown up together, and we're just like Irv coming back after an extended vacation. So there was a known quantity, and there was a certain amount of comfort, and of course we're all in a position where whenever you get a change, you're apprehensive about your own career and what's this going to mean for you. And so most people felt reasonably secure there from that standpoint when he came back. And the other candidates were really so far removed from the Wisconsin experience that there was a great unknown about that.
I wonder how Serena Pondrum took it. She must have seen the
Don't
axe
know.
Coming.
You'll have to ask her.
I've interviewed her, but yeah. I didn't.
You never got into this?
No, I assumed it. No, I didn't.
Yeah. Well, I'm not trying in any way to demean Serena, because as I think I said previously, she was a very bright, creative, aggressive person, and in the long run, maybe that's the best kind of staff person you want, because it's a lot better to deal with people like that than it is the inert types who have to be constantly cajoled and prodded into doing something. My own experience as an administrator, I'd rather be there sword fighting every day with my staff as opposed to going down and trying to light fires under them to get them going.
I've heard criticism of Serena Pondrum's way of working and of her efficiency. That is, that she wasn't as efficient as she's presented to be.
Well, I guess one has to look at the difference between knowing a lot of things and being wise. And Serena had a tremendous capacity for assimilating information. And she was very quick in that respect. But of course, then the question becomes, how do you best use the knowledge that you acquire? And there were many things that caused concern among other people with regard to what she did with the knowledge that she had. And a university depends so much on the building of consensus as opposed to the enforcement of power. I mean, this is a highly Jeffersonian environment that we work in, that the power really of the administration derives from the consent of the governed, primarily. And if the faculty has any doubts about your representing their best interest, you are going to run into some real problems as you go along. And that was, of course, the one advantage that Irv Shane had when he came back as chancellor. There was never any doubt in anybody's mind that what he did was, at least from his perception, in the best interest of the total faculty. And it was interesting, I'm not sure if I alluded to this before, but at the last, the next to the last faculty senate meeting that he appeared at, Jim Donnelly, professor of history, who has been a constant advocate of faculty collective bargaining, got up and made this effusive speech about the qualities of Irv Shane and said what a great chancellor he had been and how he had been such a strong representative of the faculty. And he was. So he never had to fight that battle coming in. He was always viewed as one of them. And this saved him a lot of internal trouble. People may not have agreed with him with regard to what he did, but they never questioned his motivation.
Yeah.
Now, with Serena, the problem was that she never established a credibility with the faculty so that they tended to feel that she was out for her own best interests as opposed to the larger faculty interests. Mm-hmm. And I think that was some of the tension that built up over the years too. And she was seen as someone who was very self-serving in that respect. So on the one hand, she was very bright in her ability to deal with information and to research something and find out as much as you could about it. But she was not wise in the way that she used the power that she began to amass unto herself as a result of her association with Ed Young.
Is she important? Is that period important? Or is it just a curiosity, it's certainly of great interest in everybody who wants to talk.
No,
about
I
it.
Think it's important because it's really essential to understanding the many, many checks and balances that have to exist within a an administration. And particularly at a university like this, where you don't have this strong hierarchical model, even though we've had some application of that over the past few years. Fred Harrington, of course, was a very strong, individually oriented type and felt that he was the ultimate possessor of truth and wisdom.
But, of course, he never really ran the Madison campus.
Well, I think you have to go back, and I'm not that familiar with this, but you have to go back and look at what sort of influence he had when he was vice president under Elvium. He may very well have run the campus. But he, see, when he was there, at that time, we still had A.W. Peterson around. And A.W. Peterson, of course, had his finger on the budget. And that's a very important element. And that of course, is one of the hallmarks of the Irv Shane administration, is that he pulled that budget right into the chancellor's office. And there wasn't anybody else administering the budget besides him.
Which was unusual, wasn't it?
Well, you see, you go back to that's part of the problem with Percy, is Percy was under Clodius, and Clodius ran the budget, as is the conventional pattern. We've drifted away from that in the past several years. Clodius being the academic vice president and having most of the budget in his office at that mm-hmm. time, and Percy being his, at least initially, deputy in this whole area. Oh, I've been diddling around with this.
I don't think that would affect it. It might.
Oh, okay.
Go on.
Well, we were talking about the counterbalances that exist within any administration, and I think it's important if you look at recent years, that is from, let's say, the post-World War II on, as the administration gets more complex and segmented, that the balance then becomes even more crucial.
Is testing 1, 2, 3, 4? Would you just say something?
Yeah. Now is the time for all good people.
Oh gosh, you had to put people in there now,
yeah.
Do you?
Right.
I don't. Maybe we.
You got to plug yourself in now.
Yes, the light is on. It's not trying.
Now is the time for all good people. And with this segmentation then comes these little pockets, all vying for influence, power, and so your equipoise within the organization becomes very crucial. And whenever any one of those segments begins to develop a power which is disproportionate to its intrinsic worth, if you will, then you start to beginning to get these balances that are affected, and this creates undercurrent and something which has a tremendous influence on who gets to the center of the action. Each of these segments has its own rationale, that is, functional rationale, which fits into the larger whole then. And when one of those functions begins to take on, as I said, greater importance than it actually deserves, then you really start getting things out of joint. And then the power plays come into play. Now, I think I suggested earlier that, for the most part, we do not get involved in what one would consider the classic office politics kind of activity that would go on.
Sounds like rather a miracle.
Yeah, know. It is. I think it's rather distinctive, and I think that this is an important consideration over the years, that we don't waste a lot of time with internal office politics. We are more free then to concentrate on the issues. Now, I don't say that they come out any better as a result of that, but we do have more energy to focus on the basic issues as opposed to who's getting credit for what and how does that enhance their own stock. So I think this university is somewhat distinctive in that respect. But there's, in any organization, it's like in any family. whenever you have three, the number three on, you're going to start getting some sort of disproportion entering the equation, whatever it may be.
It ought to work between the president and the chancellor, too, oughtn't it?
Well, there, you see, then you begin to get some basic organic difference. If you take a look at the president, who is the president of nothing, technically, other than a bureaucracy, the president has no faculty and no students. All he has is a staff of bureaucrats. Now, I don't mean to say that all the people on the staff are bureaucrats in the sort of cliched sense of the word, but they are. Their primary function is to do bureaucratic things, not to teach classes or do research. Now, if you look at the chancellor, he has a faculty and a staff, and he has students, all dedicated to the academic enterprise. I mean, the ultimate value of the chancellor is his ability to elicit from the faculty or to provide them with the support that they need to do the mission that they're here to do, and that is teaching, research, and service. Whereas the president's primary function is to gather unto him a bureaucracy which then gives the at least illusion that you're managing the place. Well, who can manage a UW system? I mean, how do you manage something like that? Especially when you do have to go through all of the chancellors and there's a strong sense of autonomy among the various institutions. So that kind of relationship is very difficult to forge except on a personal basis. But professionally, the nature of the two organizations are substantially different, and this is going to be one of the major tensions all the time.
Well, what happened next then? Irshane came and got rid of Serena. Then what?
Well, then he started to advance his program. Bry was sort of on board concurrent with that, I believe. I think that he filled in for Borchers. And so then one of the next things we had to do was, he was acting at that time, we had to do a search for the Vice Chancellor of Academic Affairs. And I didn't realize it at the time. I wasn't sure that Bry was even interested in the job. I think he was just doing this because he had served in that capacity before, and being connected with Glenn Pound through the Ag School, that this was a natural sort of thing to happen. So we went looking for a vice chancellor, and eventually Bry got appointed to the full-time post. And I was surprised myself because, as I said, I didn't think he wanted to do that, because most of what he had been doing previous to that was this international education
thing. Well, he'd been Vice-Chancellor.
Yeah, but that was several years previous, you see. And he had been in the Far East for, oh gosh, 3, 4, 5 years before he came back. So he had been fairly fresh back to the campus when he filled in for Borchers. And I had thought that maybe he was going to carry on in that whole international education area. So yes, we filled that position. Then shortly after he got here, I believe it was that February or March, Irv went off to China. This was his second trip to China. And at that point, then he negotiated the agreements, which led to the establishment of our interchange with the People's Republic on the visiting scholars. And ever since then, that is 1978, we've been a leader in this exchange program, primarily because of Irv's initiative, and he went back one or two times after that, I believe, to further advance this, and he's very highly thought of overseas, and still has a tremendous influence with the Chinese embassy. And then that summer, we had our first group of Chinese scholars that came here in late June, early July. And that program's been going strong ever since. So he got his administrative ducks lined up, and then the rest of it's pretty much just the periodic approach to the budgets and various things that come along. Of course, he's known for developing the research park. We don't yet know what the ultimate impact of that is going to be, but it's showing promise. It's getting going, and we have buildings there on that site, and gradually things are coming together. Two initiatives that are still unresolved at the moment are the suggestion of a new convocation center and then the major capital campaign. Those are still, as of this date, being planned, so it's hard to say. The rest of it's just kind of cause and effect activity, much of it having to do with the budget, and then of course we got into the faculty pay issue, and there are these ongoing things that crop up with regard to the relationship between O'Neill and Shane.
Yes, well, I have some questions. I would.
Yeah.
How was it? Did you have much to do with Bright Curl?
No.
As Vice Chancellor?
No. Not much.
But Shane must have chosen him out from the list.
Oh, yes.
They were.
Yeah, they're soulmates.
They are?
Yes.
That's nice.
They had apparently known each other. I didn't know this till much later, but they had known each other much earlier in some sort of faculty connection, and I'm not sure to this day what that was, but it goes back to the late 50s, early 60s, I believe. So I was very surprised because I didn't realize that there was this prior connection between the two of them. But they are two of a kind mm-hmm. when it comes to
what do you mean?
Administering place. They do not brook fools. They are very direct in dealing with individuals. Sometimes not very adroit, sometimes ruthless. So I think that whole thing needs to be looked at, and I'm not the one to do that.
You mean?
And you see, well, the
interviewing Bright Curl,
yeah. All right. Well, one of the key things one has to understand with regard to the function of the campus, at least in this particular era that we're talking about,
yeah,
is there has to be a very effective. Are you off or on?
No.
You're still going. Effective relationship between the chancellor and the vice chancellor. Now, as I mentioned earlier, the relationship between Irv and Ed was ideal because Ed did the outside stuff and Irv did the inside stuff, and both were happy. Ed was happy that he had somebody of Irv's skill to do the inside stuff, and And Irv was happy that he didn't have to get involved in all of the, you know, what he considered to be sort of time-wasting activities that Ed did. Now, when you get somebody with a management style like Irv's, which is very hands-on, and he does not delegate much in the final analysis. Mm-hmm. If you had someone in the vice chancellor's slot who had a mind of his own, in other words, whose thoughts were that sufficiently different from Irv's, you would have a lot more problems. But if you had somebody like Bry who thought the same way that Irv did, who reacted to people the same way Irv did, then Irv had himself covered there, and he didn't have to worry then too much about that position ever developing a dynamic which would counterbalance his management decisions. And he was not willing to delegate to that office anything to any great extent.
Which he should have done, presumably.
Well, I mean, that's the historic model, and it is, if you look around at most universities, that's the way things go, is that there usually is a provost or an academic vice president or chancellor, what have you, who runs a campus on a day-to-day basis, and the chancellor or the president takes care of then the external relations primarily and the symbolic activities and doesn't get that involved in the day-to-day management. Now, I think if you look at some of the crises that Irv got himself into over a period of time, that you can attribute that to his hands-on management, and he got himself too involved in the actual day-to-day events too early, instead of sacrificing up some of his lieutenants like me or others. And I, from time to time, volunteered to throw my body on the hand grenade or what have you, because I think that's the way it should be. And the chancellor has to leave himself a little room to maneuver. See, that was the thing about Ed Young. We had a hell of a lot of problems during the time that Ed was chancellor, and that was just the nature of what was going on. But you didn't see Ed Young right there in the middle of everything. He was always off to one side. Everybody was always wondering, well, what the hell does Ed Young think about this? Or what's Ed Young going to do about this? In the meantime, somebody else was taking the day-to-day heat for this. And Ed was out somewhere behind the scenes maneuvering, doing something, obviously. But nobody quite knew what. Whereas when you contrast that with Irv, he was right there in the middle of things, thrashing around and taking all of the body blows early in the game. And so that was the price he had to pay for being so directly involved in the day-to-day administration. If you look at Bry Curl, too, in terms of the budget activities, when Irv was vice chancellor, the budget was in his office. When Bry Curl was vice chancellor, the budget moved over to the chancellor's office in the person of Glenn Watts. And Glenn reported directly to Irv as chancellor, not to Bry Curl.
Run through that again.
The day-to-day responsibility for the budget when Irv was vice chancellor was in the vice chancellor's office.
When Young was chancellor.
And then when Irv became chancellor, the budget migrated from the vice chancellor's office to the chancellor's office.
Because he wanted to have
the direct say in the allocation of resources.
Because he was so good at it.
Yes. Right, and because it's part of his basic management philosophy. Mm-hmm. That he believes the way you run the place is to know where every nickel is. Mm-hmm. And as I think I said earlier, he did.
Oh, you didn't say that.
Yeah. Well, I remember him telling me that one time when I was involved in first taking over my responsibilities for what we now call Office of Publications, or I'm sorry, Office of Public Information. At that time was News and Publications. And he said, you know, if you're going to run this place, you got to know where every nickel is. And that was his advice to me. Well, he just, it's just part of his...
You think that would be a full-time job?
Emotional and intellectual makeup. Mm. And if you look at him, he's a physical scientist, and that goes... I think I mentioned this earlier, if you're analyzing a substance, you want to know all of the chemicals that are in it.
Was it hard on him being at the center of these things and getting the flak? Did he mind it?
No, he had a pretty good capacity to absorb a lot of that. I think he kind of relished it deep down because it was a way of getting attention.
Hmm.
I think he liked the being the center of, on the center of the stage. It was a kind of ego trip for him. But, you see, inherent in this is also a fundamental insecurity. I mean, if you feel you got to know everything, and you can't trust anybody, and you got to run everything, that must deep down say that you're not quite sure. And you're not secure enough to delegate out to people responsibility and then let them develop as a result of that and handle these things. So there's a sort of contradiction that comes in play as a result of that.
What did that leave for Bri to do?
I don't know. You'll have to ask him.
Kind of hard on him.
Well, I'm not sure. That's a whole uncharted sea as far as I'm concerned, but I think it is something that is worth asking questions. Some of us felt that Bri's office was kind of like one of those black holes in the universe, is that something went out in there, but it never came out again, and you never knew what happened to it. So...
How would you ask him about it?
I wouldn't.
No, how will I?
How would you ask him?
Yes.
Oh, I don't know. I'd just ask him what he saw as his primary responsibility as vice chancellor. I mean, was it program development? Was it academic development of one sort or another? Or was it most of, at least from where I sat, I saw the primary function of that office was running a personnel system. But it certainly was not academic affairs in the traditional sense of the word, as trying to set some sort of tone for the institution as far as its academic goals.
Because Shane was doing that.
Yeah. And as far as asking the faculty what they're here for in the first place and trying to decide what should we be doing in research and teaching? What kind of service should we be doing? Some of that began to develop as the merger with Extension began to grow. And in those discussions, we took a look at some things.
We?
Well, we being the university, about how much outreach should be, oh, we be doing. You see, if you look at what happened, when Fred Harrington pulled Extension out of Madison and made it a separate entity, we then lost the very thing that had endeared us to the people of the state.
Yes, that's been said many times.
Yes. Yeah. And therefore, when we got into the 1980s and
all of the state universities had grown and developed these constituencies, and the legislature and the regents no longer saw this connection between the people of the state and Madison. Our people began to realize, that is our deans, that hey, we're not communicating with the people that we should be communicating with, and therefore we need this outreach function, which is now over an extension, to do that. And so we began to ask some of those fundamental questions about how much of this should we be doing, what sort of program should we be putting together. Much of this is in the area of technical expertise, engineering, ag, business, where you have one thing that's grown up over the years is the professional development activity. If you look at our first contact in this area, it was with the farmer. Most of our outreach activity was agriculturally oriented. And
let's stop. This is take 4 of the interview with Art Hooper.
And so now, as society grows more complex, and we have this proliferation of a technocracy, I guess you could say, there's more need to interrelate with people in a number of different professions areas. And so our schools and colleges definitely felt that they were being cut off from the practitioners to a certain extent. And now with the evolution of the university outreach program, which Bri headed up, I think we have begun to deal with some of these questions that may not have been dealt with when he was simply Vice Chancellor for Academic Affairs.
Are you saying that there wasn't much program planning or thought about where the university should
go? No, I don't think we've, for a long time, which is interesting, asked those basic questions, because two things happened in the 1960s that dealt with this. One is this committee that involved people like Reed Bryson, Van Potter, Dave Barris. Yeah, the Committee on the Future of Man, which looked at this question of what are we all here at this university for in the first place, and came up with this very eloquent statement.
Surely nobody paid much attention to that.
Well, I think it was a kind of re-articulation of what everybody understood, but you need to go through this periodically. You need to remind people of what you're here for, basically. And this was a very eloquent statement of that. Mm-hmm. And it was at a time when we needed it. Then the next thing that developed was this committee that Irv Shane headed up before he was vice chancellor, deciding what should be some of the emphases that we take over the next few years.
What committee was that?
Well, I'm not sure exactly what it was, Committee on the Future of the University or what have you. And Irv was the head of that committee, and Peter Bunn was his associate at that time. And of course, Peter and Irv were very close throughout the time that he was chancellor, and he was vice chancellor and chancellor. Peter then later became his assistant as vice chancellor and later secretary of the faculty. And so that was the last time, to my knowledge, when Irv headed this committee, that we asked ourselves as a university, what are we all here for? Except for the development of the mission statements. And those mission statements are really, that's just real boilerplate. That isn't much of anything.
But you didn't have much to do with those either.
No. So we haven't asked ourselves that question for a long time. And one of the interesting things about administration, if you look at it,
is that, and I may have mentioned this last time, I'm not sure, we don't have very many intellectuals in the classic sense of the word.
Yeah.
And so I think you need to look at that and understand that. I guess you'd have to go back, really. Fred Harrington was an intellectual in some respects. But you'd have to go back to Van Hise.
Yeah, well, you talked about that, and it's an interesting point. But are you saying that the academic vice chancellor's office perhaps ought to be doing that?
Yes, I'm saying one of the things, it seems to me, if you're going to have a vice chancellor for academic affairs, that an important function of that office is to set some sort of scholarly tone for the campus.
Does Bernie Cohen do that? Did he?
No, he still got into that sort of administrative treadmill, administering this personnel thing, administering the academic planning part of this. Now, maybe that's, of course, another part of the whole thing, is that the academic planning has been routinized over the last several years, so that whenever you want to start a new program, you have to develop it at the school or college or departmental level, for that matter. And then it goes through the school and college, and it comes up to the academic planning committee of the campus, and then it goes to the regents and so forth and so on.
So this might be a case where Madison's really been affected by this system, because it isn't in charge of that sort of thing.
Yeah, but the other thing is, I think every once in a while we need to ask ourselves, what are we doing in terms of research? What are our priorities? What are we doing about undergraduate education? What are we doing about making better teachers out of our faculty?
Did you ever discuss this with Shane?
Oh, yeah, from time to time. I used to write memos to Ed Young. Years ago, I wrote a memo to him saying, I think we need a school of fine arts around here, because this would provide a way of focusing people's attention on this. And later he laughed and said, oh, if you knew the problems that come out of that, if you just try to administer something like that, if you can imagine having artists and musicians and writers all together in the same bailiwick, how would you ever administer that? How would you deal with the allocation of resources and so forth? And he always thought that one of the things that saved us here was the fact that the art department was over in the School of Education, and the music school was in the College of Letters and Science, and these things were spread around, so that there was never any critical mass that developed to the point where you would drive some dean nuts. And then if you picked a dean for fine arts, where would the dean come from? Would it be a musician? Would it be an artist, a writer? And how would you ever administer something like that? So, yeah, we've talked about that from time to time, but then it becomes a sort of pragmatic administrative concern. But I still think that you can ask the questions that we asked way back in the mid-60s on what are we all here for, do that periodically and go through that exercise. That's a valuable self-assessment.
With me thinking almost entirely of Madison within the system now, that seems a very improbable thing to do, because one sees Madison is just trying to hold its own in the system and doesn't feel that it has much independence anymore.
No, but one of the interesting things right now as we talk on a national level has to do with the speeches that the Secretary of Education, Mr. Bennett, has been making over the last few months, raising some of these issues about higher education and about what faculty do. And this gets everybody excited, and he's pretty off base in some of the things that he's saying. But you may remember that over the last several years we've had fairly extensive national studies about this through what Clark Kerr was doing with the Carnegie Commission, and
through some other independent studies of one sort or another, but we really haven't followed up on any of those things internally here in terms of asking ourselves, where's the soul of this university? I'm not sure we know anymore. And that's what that statement of the Committee on the Future of Man did, is it said, all right, there's a lot of stuff that goes on here administratively, bureaucratically, on a day-to-day basis, but here's where we are in the deepest sense of the word. I'm not sure you could get agreement on that. It'd be interesting. It's like John Hunter going downtown and asking some people to sign the Bill of Rights, and they say, well, I'm not sure I don't want to sign that. How many of our faculty, if you dragged out that stadium statement, which is now 20 years old, and asked them to ratify it, how many of them would do that?
I don't think many paid much attention to it then.
Well, I'm not sure, but the significant thing is we had this interdisciplinary group at that time that did. Hmm. And they represented,
for a while,
yeah.
Well, I've been thinking about Madison and the system and the legislature. I'm curious to what extent Irshane when he came in.
That clock has been pulled.
Yes, I had to unplug it.
Yeah.
Do you want to?
No, I'm here till you want to quit.
Oh, okay.
When do you want to quit?
No.
Okay. Well, let's pursue this a little bit further.
I've been talking to the two legislators, Mary Lou Mutz and Dick Flintrop, who complained that from the very beginning, neither the system nor Madison, until it got Harry Peterson, did enough in the way of lobbying downtown. And I don't know how much you know about or had to do with that.
Yeah, well, I know a reasonable amount.
It, so I just
well, all right, let's look at that from a practical standpoint. Irv was not really involved in the lobbying process until he became chancellor. Now, we did a hell of a lot of lobbying when Ed Young was chancellor, because Ed Young was his own lobbyist. And as I suggested earlier, he had some rather intimate relations with Pat Lucy and others. So we didn't need a lobbyist at that time. Well, legislators. Well, Harlan Iverson, he was very close to Harlan Iverson, Walter Hollander, some of the key people in the legislature, that if we needed some stroking there, George Molinaro, Ed was good with those people, more effective than any lobbyist would be, because Ed was the number one guy. Now, you always have to understand that a lobbyist is merely carrying guns and butter downtown. But ultimately, that lobbyist is only so effective as his ability to deliver the boss unto the legislators in one form or another. So, in the meantime, Joel Skornicka had been given a sort of nominal responsibility for legislative relations. But Joel didn't really work at it that much. He did it in a somewhat systematic way, but not in an inspired way the way Harry did it. And I think it's important. Here's another sort of side development that really has an influence in the long run. When Len Van Ness was made vice chancellor, that meant that any sort of possible career advance for Joel was blocked, because Len always saw Joel as a potential threat to him. And so, not too long after that occurred, Joel was called in to meet with Len and Irv. And he was told that he would have a certain turf
And he would be named associate vice chancellor. And that would be his little sandbox to play in, sort of. Well, he didn't want to be delimited in that fashion. So he had higher ambitions and higher perceptions about his abilities. And the relationship between Len and Joel was always a sort of strained one, because they worked in the same areas, and Len really felt threatened by Joel.
And where did Joel come from?
Joel felt stifled by Len. Mm. Joel had been at the computer center before. Oh. Before that, he was at the union. So then, not too long after that, Joel decided to run for mayor, and as they say, the rest is history. Mm-hmm. Well, then we got Harry Peterson in, and Harry was... Yeah, he was, we were looking for a Joel's replacement, and Harry was one of the four or five promising candidates. And he had been deputy secretary, I guess, of transportation under Zell Rice previously, and Zell Rice had left, and so Harry was available. And he came in and began then to take over the legislative lobbying responsibilities. And Irv was more than happy to give him that, because Irv didn't see that as one of his primary jobs, you see. And he didn't want to be down there all the time, unless he had to be. So he entrusted Harry with this responsibility. And Harry is a student of government and likes politics and had been involved in one way or another in politics most of his life. And so he was very effective, because you really gotta like doing that. You gotta like going down there, and he carried with him a credibility because he had the complete trust of Irv. So for Mary Lou and Dick Flintrop to say this is not quite an accurate assessment of the lobbying that was going on. Sure, we didn't have a lobbyist in the visible way that Harry was a lobbyist later at the time they're talking about. But we had that was one of Ed Young's great skills. Mary Lou probably never really knew how effective Ed Young was, because she didn't see all the cards. She didn't see the full hand that Ed Young was playing. And so she may have been utilized by Ed Young in a way that she never even realized. So in response to that, we had our lobbyists down there, but nobody knew who it was. And it wasn't to somebody walking the halls, but it was somebody working the legislature in a way that was very masterful. And Ed Young,
phone calls
and meetings elsewhere, and just going to parties. You see, this is what Irv never made the connection with this. When Ed Young would go to a party or something, and there may be a legislator or two in the crowd, mm-hmm. Well, you can bet that Ed Young, somehow or another, in his sort of Mandarin way, got his message to that person if he felt it was necessary. And the guy, the woman, the man or woman may have never realized it, but they had been lobbied at the time. So.
So you were aware of this at the time.
Oh, sure. We didn't need a full-time lobbyist at that time, because Ed was so effective, and he had all of his bases covered, and he wanted to do this.
And Ed would just be lobbying for Madison, presumably.
Yeah.
Because one of the things they said was that it was important to lobby to work for the whole system, because that way they could, or at least they could get something from Madison.
Well, sure. Mary Lou was, of course, in a
a position where she would be looked on as a captive of Madison just by her location and by her husband's position. I mean, we have a husband who's a faculty member, and when you live on the west side of Madison, that carries with it all kinds of symbolism to your colleagues. So she was very effective in rising above that. Flintrop, I don't know where he enters into this at all, in terms of that.
He was chairman of the education
committee. Yeah.
Let's see, if Weaver would have been up there in the system, for a while he didn't want chancellors to be down lobbying. Did you ever get any repercussions?
Oh, I never got any real sense of that, which is, it's obvious that is a concern. It's just like chancellors don't necessarily want deans down there lobbying. So that is a natural position for any president to take. Mm,
like ag deans, you
mean? Yeah, mm-hmm. Like ag deans or pharmacy deans or business deans or engineering deans, whatever.
Do they?
Sure.
I know the ag deans.
Darn right they do. They wouldn't be good deans if they didn't. A mm-hmm. Good dean has to do this. And a good dean has to tell his chancellor that he's going to do this. But the key is that both will benefit. Where the thing breaks down is when the chancellor suddenly gets bushwhacked by a dean who's lobbied something to the point where it's an accomplished fact, and it then becomes a program that's foisted off on you that you never even were aware of. So there is that relationship that emerges in any setup, regardless of who the players are. So I don't think you can say Weaver or O'Neill or Shaw, for that matter. It's just it's something that has to be part of the understanding. But anybody who says that, I don't want any chancellors down there, has got to realize that it's a fact of life that they're going to be down there no matter what.
Mm-hmm. So from your point, you feel that the lobbying that Madison did was adequate and consistent?
No. I think, let me qualify this by saying I think that Harry has been an extremely effective lobbyist. There's no question about that. But I still feel that at this point, a big problem with regard to Madison's credibility with the legislature and with the people of the state is the fact that Irv never really felt emotionally or intellectually disposed to trying to communicate with the larger community. So I think that the next chancellor has to be somebody who has this facility, because we've got to develop a presence out there which we don't have now. Otherwise our credibility is going to erode even further.
Why didn't he do it? I mean, you say he didn't like to, but he must have known he ought to.
Well, in any job situation, you do what you're best at. And he did what he was best at. That is, as I say, this very hands-on type of administration.
But sometimes you have to do things you don't like
yes.
to do and are not good at.
Well, he would do that from time to time, but it wouldn't be, it would always be a conflict for him, emotionally.
Would you encourage him and say you ought to be?
Oh yeah, yeah, we would point him in various directions and he'd do it. And we would say, we think you should go to this or that, or if you can't go, somebody else would be there. I've done this on occasion, and a lot of our other people have done this too. Go to places where our office has to be represented.
Out in the state, you mean?
Out in the state or in the community, what have you. But you see, the one thing is that people always want the number one person. And so whenever you do this, you are a surrogate at best. And they're much happier if they get the boss, even if he's not very effective, even if you do a marvelous job. Now, you see, one of the things in this area, going back to what Mary Lou was saying, if you look at during Fred Harrington's administration, we had a lot of irons pulled out of the fire because of Roy Luberg. Now, Roy was one of those guys who'd go marching uptown and would stand up in front of a group and say absolutely nothing. I mean, if you analyze what it was he said, it was just a bunch of platitudes and so forth. But Roy was such a warm and vivacious kind of guy that everybody felt just so good after he'd been to a meeting. And then
it didn't matter that he wasn't number one.
No. And they would say, send us Roy Luberg. And so he just spread a tremendous amount of goodwill as a result of that, and as I say, pulled a lot of irons out of the fire because he made people feel good. So he was a lobbyist too for us in that era, in his own distinctive way. But as far as, you have to understand at the time Roy was functioning, the composition of the legislature was a lot different. They weren't full-time legislators.
And,
yeah,
was a lot
right,
too,
right. But I'm saying from a typological or taxonomic standpoint, if you look at lobbyists, that shows you, too, the change that takes place. But Roy was just one of those feel-good type of guys.
And yes, that's been said about him.
And so he did provide a tremendous service for us, too. See, that's what I think Mary Lou and Flintrop are saying. There isn't anybody down here, or there wasn't for a time, that made us feel good in a visible way. Now, as I say, Ed Young was doing that because he was pulling all the strings as far as getting the right decisions were concerned. But he wasn't maybe necessarily that visible. Nobody else was either. So that's a fairly contorted, non-linear response to those comments.
Mm-hmm. All right, what about O'Neill and Shane and O'Neill's behavior toward the Madison campus?
Well, I think I touched on this earlier in the sense that O'Neill's experience at Indiana was, and I guess at other places, was being the provost or the chief academic officer, and he felt very strongly about being identified with the academic goals of the institution. And when he got here, he discovered that there was this very formidable roadblock between him and the faculty and students on this campus. Mm-hmm. And so that set up some tensions right away. Because O'Neill wanted to be identified in a lot of people's minds as the head of this campus, or this university.
Well, he was wrong to want that.
Yes.
He doesn't seem to have ever really understood it.
Well, accepted it. I think he understood it, but he wasn't willing to accept it. But the other thing that one has to look at, and I think I mentioned this earlier, is that I feel that O'Neill really worked hard to bring the system into being as a system. I think he made people think more about this than anybody previous to that had done.
You said that, but you didn't say how.
Well, he went to all the campuses, and he made speeches to the faculties.
Young went to the campus,
yeah, but not in the way that O'Neill went. Mm. You know, it just kind of passes through and has lunch with people and shakes their hands, but I think O'Neill was a little more assiduous than that, but nobody really liked him, you see. That was the thing about Ed Young. Everybody used to get mad as hell at him, but nobody ever disliked him, or even loving him in some respects. And so those of us who worked with him can see some of his shortcomings, but we still, I mean, if you ask all of us, we were devoted to him and really feel quite warmly about him and remember him in that respect, but also try to back off and be objective about both his strengths and weaknesses. Mm-hmm. But O'Neill was not one of those people that anyone ever developed a sense of closeness to. Now, that's interesting about Irv, too, is that some of us felt quite strongly about the heaviness of his management style, but on a personal level, we got along with him extremely well. And are close to him still on that level.
But you don't think people did with O'Neill?
No, I don't think. If you look at his staff arrangement, he had virtually no close associates at that level, except he brought in one young man, Dan Strauss, who was a young lawyer who worked with him, but he's gone now. And so as far as developing any close relationship with anyone on the staff up there, I'm not aware of it.
Did that worry you? Because it presumably meant
Sure, we, both Harry and I, worked our various sides of the street. See, I know a lot of people in system administration still from having initially started up there in the old Harrington administration, and a lot of those people are still around, so.
Okay.
So both Harry and I agreed shortly after things began to settle in that we would try wherever we could to try to avoid a confrontation between O'Neill and Shane, whenever we knew something or could anticipate something coming along. And I made some calls to various people, and Harry did too. And like Dan Strauss, like Harvey Brusher. Harvey was my principal contact, although I did contact Dan from time to time. And I developed a relationship, as I think Harry did, with O'Neill himself, and I developed a relationship with Karen O'Neill. And
how'd you do that?
Well, just this shows you how goofed up things were. O'Neill would call me from time to time and ask me about certain things because he knew I was working in one area or another, primarily institutional relations such as they are. And he would call me at the office or sometimes at home. And then I'd see him, and both on the campus or out in the community. I remember one time seeing him and Karen at a swim meet where our kids were swimming. And her mother was with them at that time. And it was my birthday, and we started talking, and I discovered that it was her mother's birthday, too. So we started talking about that. But sometimes you see you need to go around very quietly, and nobody ever knows, or I don't think Irv ever knew what I was doing. And if you're gonna do the kind of job I do, you don't tell people these things. You just go ahead and do them. And so we would go around, and Harry was working, as I say, his side of the street, and I was doing mine. And wherever we sensed that something was building, we would try to head it off. But I wouldn't run into Irv and say, hey, I saved your life today by doing this or that. I would run into him maybe from time to time and say, I think we got problems in this area. And quite often he'd say, yes, I know, or he'd say, yeah, and I've done this or that.
Could you give me an example?
Well, just the all of this, it just devolves down to the most petty things about who gets invited to what party, when O'Neill comes to a function on the campus. Why does somebody, for example, why does somebody in our one of our schools or college invite O'Neill to participate in a sort of local function? And he would accept at the drop of a hat, and sometimes he'd engineer some of these invitations. Then he would have faculty out to the house to dinner. Then there were the football luncheons.
Which they did back up.
Yeah, right. So there are all these little subtle things that begin to build up. And it's just the presence of the president in a very visible way on the campus. Now, Buzz Shaw doesn't do that to any great extent. But O'Neill, because of his, I think, intellectual interests, he's a very pedagogical type of guy. He likes to get up in front of groups and talk. And so he'd never miss an opportunity where there were faculty present to be there and talk and exchange ideas with him. And then it's somewhat ironic because he's a fundamentally shy person. And so when you see him in a social setting, he's very retiring, whereas Karen is very skillful. But another thing I got involved with him, he and I are both from the class of 1956. He graduated from Harvard, I graduated from here. And when we had our 25th reunion of our class here, I asked him to come and speak to our class because we were classmates, yes, technically. And he pointed out, too, some of the interesting connections. A classmate of his at Harvard was Carter Brown, who is the head of the National Gallery of Art. And so we were making all of these associations of all the other famous people who graduated in 1956. Well, that means more perhaps to our generation than it does now, because people don't see themselves as members of a class, because you don't graduate necessarily in 4 years and place is so large where you don't know everybody. Yeah. And we gave him a sweatshirt with Wisconsin and the number 56 on it. So, you know, these things kind of build up, and then as a result, you can go to him or you can suggest things behind the scenes in a sort of oblique way that then might switch something onto another track, and so the trains pass each other instead of ram into each other. But still, there is this constant tension that describes the whole era. And it's some of it's attributable to the fact that Irv felt that O'Neill was encroaching on his turf. And O'Neill felt that Irv was a sort of Lucifer-like figure. He wasn't listening, or he wasn't doing what he wanted him to do. And the other thing is that they didn't like each other. The chemistry between them was all wrong. And as I mentioned earlier, I think the wives, there was just terrible strain between the two of them. Let me cite you another example. Karen was very effective in developing a presence within the city of Madison in the high society, so to speak. And this then got Millie all uptight because she could see this happening. And there are a lot of women in this town who are very influential because they're influential on their husbands and they're very influential on the rest of the community. And Karen was in very tight with a lot of them. And later, in O'Neill's administration, Jane Coleman, who is the wife of Reed Coleman, who is the head of the Madison Kipp manufacturing company here in town, and who is the son of Boss Coleman, who used to be the head of the State Republican Party. Jane Coleman was given a position in university relations up in the system, and became then sort of the social secretary for the O'Neills. And that, of course, created all kinds of anxieties on the part of the Shanes, because they recognized that Jane had this pipeline to the high society of Madison, and that they would, the O'Neills would be, have an entree that the Shanes didn't have. Mm-hmm. So there are all these little things that maybe in and of themselves don't amount to much, but if you look at them as part of a larger pattern, they're very significant. But Jane is she's just an extraordinarily professional person. I think she rose above that, and she and Irv later developed a pretty good relationship when Jane became head of the United Madison Community Foundation. And Irv was, I used to sit on the board. In fact, I was at one time chairman of the Board of Governors, but then they wanted the big shots. You see, here was another example of wanting number one instead of just a representative. So Irv then went on the board, and I went off, and Jane became the executive director. And I think she developed a good relationship with Irv. And some of his earlier apprehensions were quieted. And of course, by then she had left the system administration and wasn't that direct threat that she was earlier. So there are all these little parts of the mosaic that create this strained relationship.
You look through the files and you see memos from O'Neill to Shane, which Shane doesn't, and letters, quite appealing letters, that is, he's appealing for Shane's support, or for Shane, and
yeah.
Shane doesn't answer them, which I feel sympathetic with, but it's very...
Yeah, I think I'd have to look at the substance of the issue in each case to really... make an evaluation there. Now, some of that may have been a case of it. So I think one would have to look at the this on an issue by issue basis, because some of those things you couldn't answer in the form of letters. And you see, Shane and O'Neill had a regular schedule of meetings. They would, when both of them were in town, meet almost weekly. So some of those letters may have been answered in the meetings that they had at a later date. And Irv might have brought the letter along and talked it out with O'Neill. So I don't think they're not too many conclusions that one can draw without understanding what then went on between the two of them when they did meet.
I guess the interesting thing is the tone of O'Neill's letter.
Oh yeah.
However they were answered.
Yeah. Well, you see, that's one of the aspects of his administration, is that people felt, and I think I may have mentioned this earlier, that he should have fired Phil Marshall at Stevens Point for what Phil did at the outset of those system discussions on the faculty catch-up thing. I think I mentioned
did,
that, and George Field said that too, that from his perspective that O'Neill should have done that. And Irv would come back from time to time saying, oh boy, I think I'm going to get fired, after he had met with O'Neill. He'd do that somewhat in jest, but
Obviously, things had gotten to the point where there was a really strong division of will.
Do you have any idea what, it, I mean, you say somewhat in jest, but what the issue would be?
No, I would, it would be whatever was hot at the moment. In fact, we I'm going to go off on a tangent and try to come back to this. But from time to time in our office, we get little items that come to us because somebody wants to use the university's name to sell a product. Usually it's ashtrays or blankets or caps with Bucky Badger on them or something like that. Well, one time we got a bottle of wine, which was called Bucky Red Wine. And the people who manufactured this wine wanted our permission to call it Bucky Red, and they had these little table tents where they would put them in restaurants, and then somebody would ask for the wine. And so they left behind this bottle of wine, and we have this little refrigerator in the office, and we put the bottle of wine in there. And Irv and I agreed that we wouldn't open that until the time came when he got fired by O'Neill. And so we had that bottle of wine there, and it's still there, waiting for him to get fired. Well, he never got fired. He quit. But I think it was both in jest, and he felt very real threat at some times that O'Neill would be so provoked with him that he might want to fire him. But I don't think O'Neill had sufficient votes on the regents to ever get to that point. Or he wasn't secure enough to say to the regents, either Irv goes or I go. Or he wasn't in a mood where he would want to force that issue. Because he probably realized that if push came to shove that he would go and Irv would not.
This wouldn't be things like the vet school or the nursing school?
No, I don't. They were items of much lesser consequence. I really can't say yet. I'd have to go look at the, you'd show me those letters and maybe something would come to mind. And, but I can't remember the specific issues.
It'd be interesting to see what the Madison campus's reaction
is,
let alone the whole state.
Yeah. So this relationship was always the mongoose and the snake kind of thing. And I think it would have... well, let me back up and say that Irv, I think I mentioned this earlier, Irv stayed on as chancellor even when some of his enthusiasm for the job went away.
No, you haven't
said as long as O'Neill was in that office, because he in no way wanted O'Neill to pick the next chancellor. So if O'Neill would not have left, Irv would have stayed on till the bitter end, I think. Because he wanted to protect Madison from O'Neill's influence, because I think he perceived that if O'Neill was picking the next chancellor, he would pick someone of a very servile nature who would be totally dependent on O'Neill for his identity. And then O'Neill would indeed run the UW-Madison. Now when Shaw came in, and after Irv had developed a relationship with him for a while, I think he felt much more secure that Madison would not be threatened in this way, that Shaw would not pick somebody who would be his stooge, and Shaw would then want to run the Madison in the way that O'Neill did. So I think that was a contributing factor to Irv's decision to resign, plus the
opportunity that he just simply could not pass up with Olin that he did get. I think I mentioned this earlier, but you got to look at it from perspective. When a guy gets to be 61 or 62 years old and his retirement is imminent and he's still got his health and his mind, it's awful tough for them to make that transition back then to just being what he was before, a professor of chemistry. Because you're used to that hard-charging kind of life and it becomes a part of your body chemistry.
I wonder if it was hard for Ed Gillan.
Yeah, I think it was. I think it still is.
Of course, even more so for Harrington.
Yeah. And you see E.B., take a look at E.B. Fred. I mean, E.B. poked around all of his life until he became physically incapacitated.
Harrington and Young never did that.
No, not really, but E.B., hell, he'd be in here at 5 o'clock in the morning when he was 85, 88 years old.
Upset Elfie.
Yeah. Of course, then he'd go home and go to bed at 6 o'clock. That's what people didn't ever understand.
Well, let's stop, shall we?
Yeah.